darf ich sie mittags packen.
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely surrounded by my stuff. On my right is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files, and here on my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, the eternal champion has appeared as Naomi, the assassin from The Spy Who Loved Me, a film that was converted into a game for the ZX Spectrum. Then again, weren't all films turned into a game on the ZX Spectrum at one point? Yes, this episode is all about the ZX Spectrum. Not very tabletop RPG, I hear you say. Well, no, it isn't. But if you were playing role-playing games in the 1980s, it wasn't really possible to ignore the adjacent development of home computing and console gaming. And in the UK, the ZX Spectrum was pretty ubiquitous. The Spectrum was an 8-bit home computer developed and marketed by Sinclair Research. It's one of the most influential computers ever made, and it's also one of the best-selling computers ever, with over 5 million sold. First released in the UK on the 23rd of April 1982, and around the world in the following years, most notably in Europe, the United States and Eastern Bloc countries. I got that bit off Wikipedia. Don't at me. In this episode, I'm joined by the writer Dan Whitehead, who's produced two comprehensive guides to the games on the Spectrum and a companion quiz book. Specky Nation, a tribute to the golden age of British gaming, provides a review of some of the classic and notorious titles released on the ZX Spectrum. The second volume covers the digital decade from 1982 to 1992, demonstrating how the Spectrum touched every corner of popular culture. I make the point during the interview that if you want to get a glimpse of the cultural life of a teenager in Britain in 1980s, then these books will give you all you need. The interview was recorded at Virtual Grogmeet in front of a virtual audience. I'll be back at the end of this with some news about the book club, but until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open box!
Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling. It's Virtual Grogmeet, where players of RPGs, members of the Grog Squad, listeners to the Grognard Files, are connected across the globe thanks to technology. But we're going back to the beginning and mid-80s when the idea of the internet was confined to a handful of nerds in Georgia. In the 80s in the UK, we were in the middle of a home computing boom thanks to inventor and entrepreneur Clive Sinclair. I'm joined by the Grog Squad and writer Dan Whitehead, who has produced these brilliant books, Specky Games, a tribute to the golden age of British gaming. Hello there, Dan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. I picked up these at a Comic Con in Manchester a few years ago, and they've entertained me.
Hawking my wares, yeah.
And where in the world are you beaming from, Dan?
It's kind of South Manchester. So,
You're very local.
Caught me on home turf.
Excellent. And before we continue, obviously we won't chase you away with pitchforks. But were you a role playing gamer back in the day?
Not massively, but me and my friends definitely dabbled. One of my friends had the Judge Dredd one, and we used to play that. I can't honestly say that we stuck to the rules particularly well. We mostly just kind of messed about in the world of Judge Dredd, I guess. So I don't really remember if we ever actually like completed any stories or anything like that. And I had a friend who was also into the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game back in the day as well. So I think I was more into the miniatures. I definitely had a collection of the little lead miniatures, but I think that's just because I just collected any kind of toy that looked cool back then.
Okay, well, you've passed the first test, so we'll allow the interview to continue. Because I know that 2000 AD is a big part of your writing life.
Oh, God, yeah. No, I mean, it was, you know, I don't think you can kind of grow up reading British comics and not be a fan of 2000 AD. It's kind of the pivotal kind of gateway comic, I guess, when certainly in the 80s, as you kind of grew out of kids' comics. 2000 AD was kind of there for, well, like kind of the age of 10 onwards. You could kind of pick that up and feel a bit more grown up. But, you know, certainly in the 80s, 2000 AD was still a children's comic. Whereas today, I think it's more kind of aimed at adult fans. But back then, it was still, you know, sold for pocket money and pitched at kids, even if the content was sometimes skewing more adult. So I think that's why it was useful as a kind of a gateway into more, you know, sophisticated reading.
And we might come back to 2000 AD because 2000 AD and the Spectrum's paths crossed a few times.
So we'll
And for our overseas listeners and our younger listeners, and we do have a handful of them, I think there's a couple in Milton Keynes, according to Spotify, that listen to this. Just explain what the ZX Spectrum was and how it came about and where it came from.
So, I mean, the thing you kind of need to remember about the early 80s was that there were so many different kinds of home computer. Like today, if you go out to buy a computer, you're going to buy a PC or a Mac. And that's it, really. Back then, there were, you know, there was the Spectrum, the Commodore 64, the BBC, had the BBC Model B for schools. There was the Acorn Electron, there was the Dragon 32, there was the VIC-20. There were just so many different kinds of computers, none of which were compatible with each other. And, you know, many of which were quite expensive. Certainly the BBC was really expensive because it was designed for schools. It was like a paving slab, basically. It was designed to be hammered on by kids for years and years and years. So it cost something like £700, I think, at the time, which at the time was like ridiculous money. So Sir Clive Sinclair's thing was he was much more of an inventor than a businessman, I think. You know, as a school kid, he would make kind of home kit radio sets. And he would sell them by mail order when he was a teenager. And his first computers, the ZX80 and the ZX81, were kit computers. You could buy them ready-made, but you could buy them cheaper if you just bought them as components and put it together yourself. So that was the kind of mentality Sinclair had. And he was looking at all these different competing computer sort of brands and formats. And he was very adamant that every home deserved to have a computer. So the thing with the Spectrum was that it had to be the cheapest. It was the affordable kind of British own brand computer, basically. And it had 16K memory to start with. That was later upgraded in a model to 48K, which was kind of like the standard, the Spectrum that everyone remembers. I've actually got one here that I can show you. This will show up on camera. There we go.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't see if I do it quickly like that. The ZX Spectrum 48K was, you know, very small, about the size of a book. Very lightweight, and the thing everyone remembers about it is it had rubber keys. It seems bizarre now. It was horrible to type on. It's like typing on jelly babies or something. But the reason that was kind of goes back to Sinclair's thing that it should be affordable. Obviously, molding and setting like a whole keyboard with different individually printed plastic keys is expensive.
Charlie Brooker described it as typing on human flesh.
Yes, it's a very weird feel. So what Sinclair did was, instead of like printing all the different keys individually, he printed basically a rubber mat with raised buttons on it, and then the shell of the computer had holes that these buttons would poke up through. So he could do in one piece the whole keyboard, and that helped him bring the price right down and make it affordable to everyone. And that was just like one of the weird kind of quirky aspects of the Spectrum that I think made it unique among all those computers. Most of the ones were quite corporate, quite, you know, the Commodore was American. It was very much a kind of, you know, here is a computer product, whereas the Spectrum felt a bit homebrew. It felt a bit kick-based. It felt like a thing for messing about with.
I think
I suppose it fitted into our class-based culture as well. It felt very working class. I know my friend Simon used to be quite sniffy about it because he had a Vic 20 and we all had Spectrums.
Yeah, no, it was definitely, I mean, you know, I don't think Sinclair was any kind of class warrior, but he was definitely convinced that everyone deserved to have access to a computer because, quite rightly, he realised, you know, in the future, computers are going to be absolutely central to everything we do. So he wanted as many people as possible to have access to it. And, you know, yeah, I think, I can't remember exactly how much they cost when they came out, but it was around £100, which, you know, at the time for, you know, a computer, which was this like brand new, amazing electronic gadget that was like really high tech and space age, £100 was like, wow, that's, you know, that's crazy cheap for, you know, something that's going to change the world.
And I suppose it was pitched at our parents as a great educational tool. They assumed that we were going to take this and become future NASA scientists, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of classic thing that people say, you know, you tell your parents it'll help with your homework. That's how you convince them to get it for your birthday or Christmas. You know, no, it'd be great for my homework. And there were a lot of educational kind of software and games and stuff. One of the games that came packaged with the Spectrum was called Survival, which was a kind of natural history program where you had to like play as a different animal and see how long you could survive in the wild. Not massively full of educational content, I don't think, but it kind of gave that impression of being a bit more nourishing for the brain than Space Invaders, certainly.
Yeah, and I remember that it had a simulator where you could adjust the population of hares and wolves, foxes in an area and try and predict the populations.
Yeah, anything like that was, you know, it's the thing I always think about that era. It's just how amazing it felt to do anything on a computer. Certainly in the home, the idea that the telly is now something you can interact with was mind-blowing at the time. You know, I mean, I was 9 when the Spectrum came out, the 48K, and the idea that I could have something running on the TV and I could press buttons and make things move on the TV was unbelievable. The TV was just a thing that sat in the corner and beamed programs at you. Now it was something you could do stuff on and it would respond and react. That was huge.
Yeah, it was a bit of a Trojan horse as well as a way of getting a TV in your room, wasn't it? Because yes. Otherwise you'd have to commandeer TV. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's how I did it. Was, you know, my parents were so sick of me hogging the TV and then sulking when I had to turn it off so they could watch Antiques Roadshow or whatever. But yeah, I finally got like a portable TV in my room on Christmas. And then I don't think they saw me for another 10 years because why would I ever need to leave the room?
I suppose we're right. We're used to the idea of using the TV because of games consoles and cartridge kits. But I suppose part of the ritual of using the Spectrum was using the cassette player as well, wasn't it?
Mm. That was the other thing as well, that games came on cassettes, which were something you already had. So there was kind of like it kind of demystified it in a way. It wasn't like, you know, you buy like a cartridge for the Nintendo and it's just a plastic brick and you've got no idea what's going on in there. But a cassette, you understand how that works more or less. You know, it's recorded linear sound and you play it through. You're not quite sure how those kind of screeches and screams that came out of the Spectrum were translated into computer programs because we didn't really know that's what data sounded like. It was something that felt familiar, but at the same time, absolutely space age. You know, this cassette that, you know, had your Duran Duran copy on could now also have games on it somehow. So, yeah, it was both familiar and also weirdly space age that you could have games on them. So, and also, of course, it made it easy to copy the games.
Absolutely, yeah. Perhaps come on a bit more about that. But the other thing about it, I think, for our generation, it gave us a resilience, patience and empathy with machines. It didn't always work, did it?
Yeah. Oh, God, no. I mean, loading a game on the Spectrum, our tape loading error was the error message that would come up when it failed to load. And yeah, that was like the bane of your life. You know, sometimes you had some games would load at different volumes. So I remember my tape recorder had like little lines drawn alongside the little volume dial to kind of show if you want to load Attic Attack, I need it to be there. But if I want Manic Miner, it needs to be there. And just mad stuff like that. But yeah, there was kind of tactile thing to it. I think it's overplayed, like how much time you had to wait to play the game. You know, I mean, certainly when I like switch on my PlayStation now and I have to wait for like a 30 gigabyte update to download or something, it's not massively different to the Spectrum days in that respect. Yeah, you know, you had to commit to it. You know, if you're going to load a game, there's a certain time commitment there just getting it up and running. So you kind of had to go, okay, well, I'm going to play it for a good amount of time. You didn't just like wait 5 minutes to load a game and then play it for 30 seconds and switch it off. You had to stick with it. So you kind of had to commit.
As it was loading, there was a certain display, wasn't there? So you got a sense of whether it was loading from, I was convinced anyway, by whether the lines were going the right way or...
people don't remember it or never saw it, but the Spectrum would have like the kind of the preloader, which was when it kind of like recognized the first bit of data on the tape, which tells it what the program is going to be. And you get like these red and blue lines around the border of the screen that kind of went up and down with a kind of noise. And then as it was loading the bulk of the data, they would change to like yellow and dark blue. And yeah, usually there would be like a loading screen, which would kind of fill in as it loaded. And it's weird to think now that was entertainment in itself, you know.
Yes.
Buying a new game, I would be genuinely excited to see what the loading screen would be like, which seems bizarre now. You'd sit there and go, what's it going to be? Is it going to be a good one? Is it going to be rubbish? And it was almost like kind of Tony Hawk, kind of like it would draw it like line by line and then fill them in, and then the colour would kind of cascade down. So it was a kind of like a real kind of, you know, can you guess what it is yet kind of aspect to it.
Yeah. And that sound as well, you could tell whether if the volume dropped, you knew that you had to abandon it and start again. You just got tuned to it.
Yeah.
When I look at these books, they're really good books, by the way. You can lose hours in falling into into them. At the start, you do make the point that this is a period of time when. And I think Phil South in his introduction says as well, this is a period of time where it was possible to be really creative with what you had because you had very little to work with. Therefore, you had to use your imagination as a developer and as a user. So do you want to talk about that and some of the innovations that these programs and games had?
Yeah, so I mean, the thing is, back then, the idea of computer games was still pretty new. I mean, the first like official video game was Space War in 1969, and you know, obviously you had Space Invaders in the 70s and then sort of early 80s when you start getting Pac-Man and all that kind of stuff, but it was still a pretty open field. You know, there was no kind of like dogma about this is what a computer game is, so everyone who developed a game for the Spectrum was basically starting from scratch a lot of the time. You know, they were all solving the same problems, but in their own way and having to find their own way to it. And when I say solving problems, I mean, just mean like getting things to move on the screen was a huge task. Getting the graphics to scroll was a huge thing because you've only got 48K of memory to play with. And, you know, that's a tiny, tiny amount of memory when you think about it, like a JPEG of the cover of a Spectrum game takes up more memory than the actual game, which still blows my mind. It's like, how did they get entire games into this like tiny footprint of memory? So, yeah, I mean, basically every developer was having to just work out the basics of like, how do you control games? How do you move things around on the screen? How do you keep scores? How do you do this? Whereas if you compare it to games now, you can pick up any kind of first-person shooter and, you know, you don't have to look at the instructions because they all use the same controls now. They all use the same kind of formulas and techniques and things like that. It's all very familiar, you know, the same with like Assassin's Creed kind of sandbox type games. You can pick them up and you know, you run up to a car, you press the triangle button on the PlayStation to get in the car. You know, you press this button to duck, you press this button to fire. It's always the same. Whereas back then, there was none of that stuff. It was just everyone was starting from scratch and kind of going, okay, what's, you know, how do we do this? And so a lot of the stuff was crap because, you know, a lot of the ideas they had just didn't work. But then every now and again, you get something that was like, oh, you know, they had to be ingenious just to get a game working on the Spectrum. To get a game that worked on Spectrum and was good, you had to be really kind of smart and innovative in how you use that computer. And the other thing with the Spectrum is that I won't try and hold it up again because that really didn't work. But if you kind of look at this, the keyboard of the rubber key 48K Spectrum, the keys are covered in stuff. There's the letters, obviously, but above each letter, there's like, so let's see. So the W key has W. Underneath that, it has the word draw. It has two angled brackets. It has cosine above it. And it has something called ACS underneath it. So there's like five functions on one key. And there's like, there's a shift key. There's a symbol shift key. It's like runes. It's like this weird archaic language. But what I've grown to love about that is that to even just to have a Spectrum, just to load a game on the Spectrum, you had to engage with it.
Yes.
You had to understand a little bit about how games were loaded, how basic code works, because you had to press load speech mark, which basically tells the computer to load whatever is the first thing that comes through on the tape. And so just that little bit, you're learning a little bit about the basic programming language. And, you know, even if you never went any further than that, just looking at the keys kind of gives you a hint of what does that do? Why is that there? What does that mean? So, yeah, you were kind of subtly being encouraged to understand the nuts and bolts of the thing just by using it.
Yeah, and as well, the culture around it was the magazines encouraged you to program it, didn't they? They provided programs that you would diligently do. And White Dwarf, back in the day when it was a role-playing magazine, that would feature some programs that you could copy in to create characters and things like that.
Yeah, no, that was a huge thing as well. All the games magazines, and of which there were loads. You know, I mean, the Spectrum alone had like three big newsstand magazines, and they would have sections of, you know, programs that you would copy off the page and type in to make your own games. And all of these magazines kind of grew out of what were basically hobbyist magazines in the very early 80s, which was back when, you know, if you had a computer, it's because you were, you know, a computer engineer type person who, you know, wanted to work in the guts of computers. It was only when games came out that they started, magazines started to like cover games more as an entertainment medium. But they still had a sort of residual DNA of, you know, well, of course you're going to want to type things in. So here are some things. And of course you'd spend hours, like a whole Saturday afternoon, typing this thing in to get a, you know, a cruddy Space Invaders clone. And then it wouldn't work because you've missed a semicolon on syntax one of the lines.
Syntax error.
Yeah, so you'd either have to, you know, you got a little bit of a taste of, you know, bug fixing and going back through the code and checking for mistakes, or you just went, oh, sod it, I'm going out.
Yeah. I suppose, and the first experience of thinking, do I need to put a REM in? And realizing at that point when it doesn't work that it would have been a really good idea to put the REM in anyway. I mean, the thing that strikes me about these books is how it touches on so much of popular culture at the time. And we'll go into some of the games, but everything seemed to have its own game, didn't it? Everything from Robin of Sherwood to the Weetabix skinheads had their own. So if you want to see 80s culture, you just have to look at this book.
Yeah, I mean, that was the idea behind Speculation 2, which is this one. It's the blue one.
Yeah.
That is called, subtitled, The Digital Decade, because that is all about all the tie-in games that were made. And, you know, I mean, everyone kind of remembers the games that were based on, like, big movies or big TV shows, you know, like the Knight Rider game that Ocean Software published. There was, like, a Fall Guy game, Airwolf game, all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, you're right. There was just, because computer games were kind of seen as the hot new thing, you know, they're the cool thing that kids are into now. So loads of brands jumped on it, loads of, it was just, you know, if you wanted to kind of get people's attention, you would quickly bang out a cheap spin-off game like Shaking Stevens, the Welsh Elvis. He had a Spectrum game. He had a Spectrum game. It was recorded on the end of one of his albums on cassette. And You know, I'm sure he had no idea about it and had no idea what it was about. But you load it up and you get like a Spectrum picture of Shaking Stevens, and then you drive a car around a maze being chased by bats. I don't know what that had to do with Shaking Stevens, but the shaky game exists because somebody at the record company went, hey, we should do a game. And they did it.
I suppose you would get bats in This Old House, wouldn't you? Maybe that's the thing. Anyway.
I think the idea was you're trying to get to the This Old House in the middle of the maze, but it was a very tenuous connection, to be honest. I suspect the game was one of those ones you type in out of a magazine and they just added Shaking Stevens afterwards.
Yeah. I remember Piccadilly Radio in Manchester. They once broadcast a game. So they had all the wails and screeching and you had to record it. And it was called Tim Grundy's Nose. Tim Grundy was a DJ on Piccadilly. I could never get it to work, though. I couldn't tell you what it did.
Yeah, I mean, because computer code could be recorded as audio in those days, because it came on cassette, there was all kinds of ways you could do that. Like CFAX or Oracle used to broadcast games in the middle of the night, or software packages that you could like hold up a cassette and try and record it off the TV and then load it into a computer. You know, bands would do, you know, like Shaking Stevens did on his album. Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks, he did an entire album which had a software Spectrum game. Well, not obviously even a game, it was like a weird kind of digital music video, I guess. The idea was you would load it up and then it would play alongside the record. So there's lots of stuff like that, you know, just lots of weird ways of, you know, how, you know, if we can just broadcast this sound to people, they can get a game.
But let's look at some of these games then in a bit more detail, pick out some highlights. So what we like to do here, Dan, is we put this Games Master screen up between us. Okay. And I've got a table here that I'm going to roll on, apparently at random, and pick from some of the highlights of some of the games that might be familiar to people, or we can explain them how they work. So let's roll the first one. Okay. Ah, we've got a critical hit here, actually. I rolled a two, which is from 1982, The Hobbit.
Yeah. So text adventures were a huge thing, especially on the Spectrum, because it wasn't great at moving things around at high speed. So, you know, any game where you just had to put text on the screen and, you know, kind of like a static picture above it for some of the screens, I think they were a huge deal. And The Hobbit was an absolutely massive hit. It sold like over a million copies. It's a very, very abridged version of the story. You kind of start in Bilbo's house, and then in about three screens, you're in Mirkwood. And it's, you know, so it's a very kind of rushed version through it. I think you can finish the whole story in about 10 minutes if you know what you're typing in. But yeah, I mean, it was a huge, huge hit, that. And one of the things the Hobbit game did, which still really impressive, was it had what we would now call NPCs, non-player characters. So characters like Gandalf, characters like Thorin, they weren't just, you wouldn't just like enter a scene and it would go, oh, Gandalf is here. And you go, okay, talk to Gandalf. Gandalf would wander around the game on his own. He would wander in and out of scenes. And Thorin would wander in and out of scenes. And Thorin was very fond of sitting down and singing about gold. Just randomly, the game would decide that Thorin's going to sit down and sing about gold. So, I mean, it was very basic, but it felt like they were real. They were alive. They were doing stuff without you, which was kind of amazing. And I think, I'm fairly sure they could die. Like, it was possible for them to wander off and get killed, and then you just couldn't finish the game.
Yeah, I think if you wandered too far, a pair of bulbous eyes appeared, and that was the end of the game. Yeah.
Yeah. Games were pretty brutal back then. If you kind of went beyond the boundaries of what they wanted to do, they'd just kill you and try again. Tough.
It is an abridged version, and I think I realised that my understanding of what happens with the trolls, when I saw the film and when I read the book again recently, I assumed that it was Bilbo who had the idea of waiting and waiting and waiting until the trolls turned to stone, and it didn't require Gandalf's intervention. I think I got it from the game, actually. I thought...
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the kind of puzzle that kind of text adventures had to come up with, you know. I mean, you could do like inventory puzzles, like, you know, you find a rope and then, you know, in four screens time, you need a rope to do something. But you could also have ones where, you know, if you knew the book, obviously you would kind of had a big advantage because you kind of knew what was supposed to happen. But the idea of just waiting and not doing anything was, you know, if you didn't know the story, that's kind of like a really left field solution to a problem, is to just not do anything.
Yes.
And there's an Incredible Hulk text adventure as well, which famously starts with Bruce Banner tied to a chair and can't do anything, can't reach anything, can't do anything. And there's no clues as to what you're supposed to do until eventually you somehow work out that you're supposed to type bite lip. And if Bruce Banner bites his lip, he turns into the Hulk, and then you're off. You can start the game now. So stuff like that, it was very typical of those kind of games of, like, you know, you really had to do a lot of lateral thinking to kind of work out what the hell is the developer expecting me to do here.
Yeah, and your book reminded me that you have to pick up Bard the Bowman, don't you, to drop him into place.
Yeah, Bard the Bowman. You pick him up and put him in your pocket and carry him so he can shoot down smoke, which... You know, why not? It's, you know, it works. Maybe it was a piggyback. Maybe you don't put him in his pocket. But yeah. Well, that's what I mean, is they had to come up with a way for you to maneuver a character somewhere else. And, you know, we've already told the player you can pick things up. So the simplest solution, which doesn't require any additional features in the game, is you pick up people and just move them around.
I noticed as well that there was a tie-in for Warlock of Firetop Mountain, the Fighting Fantasy book. They had the cheek to just rebrand an existing game and present that, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, because The Hobbit was such a hit, and The Hobbit game, you could buy it on its own, but it also came in like a package with the book. And obviously the Fighting Fantasy series, Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson did. They were perfect for it because they were basically like computer games in book form, kind of this halfway house between kind of tabletop role-playing and adventure stories like The Hobbit and this new exciting digital field of computer games. So it's kind of inevitable that, you know, there would be games based on the Fighting Fantasy books. But yeah, the first one was literally just an existing game called Halls of the Things, which was just reskinned as Warlock of Firetop Mountain. You're just like a stick man going around a maze hitting spiders with a sword. It's got nothing at all to do with the book. But after that, they did, to be fair, they did actually start adapting the books properly. And some of them were like text adventures, and some of them had a kind of rudimentary kind of like dice rolling mechanism for combat and stuff. So they did get quite good, the Fighting Fantasy games. Although, as with a lot of that stuff, you do kind of feel like, well, why don't I just do the book? Because that's the ideal home for this kind of thing. That's where it was designed to work.
I remember as well having a, you know, Drust the Legend, and that came with a game. A lot of times you got books with games alongside them, didn't you?
So, yeah, quite a few publishers, like book publishers, quickly set up like digital computer game offshoots. I think they're called Five Ways. I think they did the Fighting Fantasy ones, maybe. But yeah, it was not unusual for book publishers to kind of jump on this bandwagon. And I'm sure it was like, you know, two or three people in a room just hastily throwing stuff together. But yeah, it was like I say, anything you could attach a game to, you know, it showed you were, you know, kind of exciting and cutting edge. And, you know, so it made sense to, if you could do a game, you'd do a game.
Okay. I'm going to roll on the table again.
Go for it.
And I've got a five. So that is go to. Platform games, and in particular Manic Miner, who I suppose is the one that everybody remembers, don't they? Because that was ubiquitous at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's Miner Willy there. So, yeah, I mean, Manic Miner was one of the defining hits of the Spectrum, developed by a guy called Matthew Smith, who was like 16 when he wrote it or something. And yeah, I mean, Manic Miner is kind of like to the Spectrum as Mario is to Nintendo and Sonic is to Sega. It's the kind of the game that everyone immediately thinks of. One of those games that I don't know how many people finished it. I don't know how many people finished any game back then without cheating, because it was pretty brutally hard. But that first, the first screen of Manic Miner, because it was like, you know, there's, it didn't scroll. It was like you were in a screen, you got to the exit, then the next screen, get to the exit. You had to pick up the keys along the way. And each screen basically had one route through that you could do without dying. And it often required ridiculously precise jumps. Like Miner Willie's like the most feeble man in history. Like if he touches like a plant, he dies. So, you know, you really had to, and there were some bits where you literally had to like jump over it with like one pixel to spare in order to miss the thing above him that will also kill him if you jump too soon or too late. So many of those games were all about just trial and error of like finding out the exact place and the exact time to jump over things. But yeah, the Spectrum had a load of platform games, but it wasn't always super great at them. You know, because like I say, just moving things around on the screen was tough. So getting characters to run and jump and things like that, it could very easily go wrong. You know, just in a programming sense, you could do it and it just felt horrible and it didn't work, but you had to shovel it out the door anyway. So it was a genre that had loads of entries, but, you know, so Monty Mole was another one that everyone remembers. Dizzy kind of came along later as more of a kind of graphic adventure. But yeah, Manic Miner, there's a purity to that one, I think, where it's just literally, here's a, you know, gauntlet of instant death obstacles. Can you get over all of them?
And it's infused, isn't it, with a sense of British humour. I think that was what was eye-catching about it. I mean, being chased by toilets in Eugene's lair and various other wacky situations. I mean, squashed at the end by a Bigfoot like Monty Python.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely a key kind of recurring feature of British games, especially back then, was there was a kind of surreal, abstract edge to them, a kind of sort of weirdness to the humour and the scenarios where, you know, you could have games where you're just like, you're being chased by toothbrushes or whatever, and you just go, okay, I'm being chased by toothbrushes. We would just accept that because I don't know why we never thought that's weird. It's just, that's what happens in games, is you get chased by everyday household objects and they're going to kill you.
What had currency on the school playground was pork codes. And I think there are people who are in this Zoom room who can probably still remember those codes. I think it was impossible to do it without those cheats.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of games. I think Manic Miner was one of them. Jet Set Willy, the sequel, was definitely one of them, where because of mistakes in the programming, they were impossible to finish unless you fixed the code yourself using these pokes, which would be published in magazines in the kind of the tips section. The tips sections were sometimes how do you do things, and often it was just like, type this in before you load the game to fix it. And what it was, the poke command basically pokes a new bit of data into the code. So what you do is you would work out, okay, this variable represents lives because that goes up and down every time you do something. And then you would just basically poke in like 99. So now you've got 99 lives. But yeah, I mean, stuff like Jet Set Willy, there was a problem with that one, famously called the attic bug, where there was an arrow in one of the rooms that went off the screen. Because the game kept trying to track this arrow, it caused a stack overflow in the data where it just completely broke down, basically. So if you went in this room too early or too late and triggered this arrow, you'd basically completely ruined the game. It was just not going to work. So that was one of the famous pokes, was like fixing the attic bug in Jet Set Willy so the game would actually work. So, you know, even today, you know, when games like have to have updates and patches to fix things, it's nothing new. It's just back then we had to do it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still playing Jetpack on an emulator on my phone. So it still has a great feel to some of those games, doesn't it? Like you said, the simplicity of them sometimes is the appeal.
Jetpack is beautifully designed. It's a wonderful game. And it was part of the Rare Replay compilation, which was released on the Xbox, because Ultimate Play, the game, which is a big famous UK games developer on the Spectrum, later became a company called Rare, which worked on Nintendo and was eventually bought by Microsoft. And it's still going today. You know, they did Kinect Sports for the Nintendo Wii and things like that. But yeah, on the 30th anniversary, they did a compilation called Rare Replay, which had 30 games from 30 years of the company's history. And I think out of the 30 games, about 7 of them were Spectrum games. So being able to play Spectrum games on an Xbox was really weird. And Jetpack is still incredibly playable because it is so simple. You're just a guy in a jetpack flying around a screen, trying to shoot the aliens, grab the fuel, drop it in your spaceship, off you go, next screen, do the same thing. And it's just so immediate. You know, I don't think that game will ever stop being fun because it's in its purest form. It's like 16K, that game, one of the very first Spectrum games. So it's tiny, tiny bit of code, and it's beautiful.
Yeah. And Ultimate also did Attic Attack, which was also a favourite of ours.
Mm. Yeah, no, I loved Attic Attack. I think Attic Attack was their best game. They kind of became famous for their kind of like isometric 3D games later, like Night Law and things like that. But I think Attic Attack was the one that was really beautifully done. Just top down, really expansive environment. You've got this whole castle to explore. But again, just really simple. You know, you need to find these things and get out of the castle. But there's all these little Easter eggs and secrets, like Dracula and Frankenstein are in the basement. And if you've found a crucifix or a wrench, you can keep them away. You know, there was 3 different character types you could play: the serf, the knight, and the wizard. And each one could use shortcuts through different scenery items. So like one of them could like go through grandfather clocks and come out on the other side. Some of them could go through barrels. So yeah, it was very simple, but also incredibly ambitious. And that's another game I can play endlessly even to this day.
Yeah. Let's roll again. I've got a 10, and it's Prog 10. We mentioned 2000 AD, but there were some notable 2000 AD tie-ins. Perhaps talk through a couple of those. I mean, one of my favourites was the Strontium Dog, the killing that they emulated from the story is one of my favourite stories, but there were others, weren't there?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, in Speculation Volume 2, there's a whole section on games based on comics, because there was like a Dan Dare game, there were other ones. But yeah, 2000 AD produced loads, and obviously 2000 AD is now owned by Rebellion, which is itself a games developer. So I think there were a couple of Judge Dredd games, which were pretty good. There was one where you had to like, you could actually like respond to crimes on a map screen, and then Judge Dredd would kind of like stomp around these kind of like platforms trying to find the perp. There was Nemesis the Warlock game, which was really nicely programmed, but quite basic. You were just Nemesis, and you're just whacking dozens and dozens and dozens of enemies over and over again, trying to get to the exit on the screen. But you could, as the bodies piled up, you could actually use them as platforms, which I thought was a very 2000 AD kind of twist on the platform game formula. You can literally pile up the dead and use them as a platform. What else was there? There was one of the strangest 2000 AD games was Slain. And I know there's a lot of debate about how you're supposed to pronounce that, but I'm not going to attempt the Celtic version. Yeah. You know the one I mean, the barbarian guy. That one was kind of an adventure game. You'd think, you know, he's famous for his berserker rages and his axe, and you think you'd just make a game where you just go around killing people with an axe. No, it was like a text adventure, but instead of typing things in, you had like an area of the screen which represented Slain's mind, and thoughts would float through of things he might do. And you had to guide this kind of like disembodied hand with blood dripping from the stump and click on the thoughts while they passed through his mind to get him to do anything. And I mean, it's a very clever idea. It didn't really work, but it's in Speculation Volume 1. It's one of those games that I thought, that's an ingenious solution to a problem. It doesn't really work, and it's not particularly playable, but the fact that somebody went, oh, well, you know, you click on the thoughts in his head to make him do things is the kind of sort of weird left-field solution that people had to come up with in those days. I'm much happier that that game exists than if it was a platform game with a guy with an axe, to be honest with you, just because the fact that game exists in that form is hilarious to me.
The Strontium Dog game did have a lot of replayability. It was a very frustrating game, but yeah, you just had to hunt people down through various stages. Good fun.
Yeah, and that was one of the rare ones that actually adapted a storyline from the comic as well. The Rogue Trooper game was good as well. Kind of isometric, kind of explore them up, shoot them up kind of deal. So that was really nicely done. Most of the 2000 AD games were good, to be fair. And there were quite a few that never came out. There was like a game that was planned for Judge Anderson, where she would have fought Judge Death, that was announced, but then just never happened. Lots of companies would like get these licenses and announce games and then go out of business, and the games would just never see the light of day. A Halo Jones game was apparently coming as well, but God knows what that would have been like.
It's incredible to think, isn't it, that there was such a proliferation of them, so many of them. And Ian Livingstone, in his recent book, Dice Men, talks about how Games Workshop was nearly bankrupted by the amount of stock they had of these games, because it just got saturated and they'd overinvested in the stock. So what was the point where it kind of all started to fall apart, as it were?
I mean, there were a frankly ridiculous number of games for the Spectrum. That's because it was an incredibly popular machine with like millions of computers out there. Not to mention like kind of clones of the hardware in places like Spain was quite a big Spectrum market. So there was like a huge market that needed lots of software. And that, coupled with the fact that you could technically write a game at home, record it on a tape. Not many people did that. There's the kind of the idea of the bedroom coder, and that was certainly true in the early days, but it was still fairly cheap to, you know, make a game. You could do it with like two or three people, record it on cassettes. You know, publishers definitely kind of just went flood the market. I think there's well over 10,000 games for the Spectrum, which is an astonishing amount when you kind of consider like the size of libraries on like consoles these days, because you have that barrier to entry of being on a console. You know, I think the only thing that's comparable is stuff like the Apple App Store now and Steam for PC and things like that, where if you want to publish a game, you can. And that's those kind of digital services have kind of brought back that mentality. And they're having the same problem, which is basically just visibility is hard because every day there's like another 100 games coming out. So, I mean, the Spectrum really started to decline kind of around the 90s, the early 90s. It wasn't really a problem with the Spectrum itself. It was just that hardware had moved on. There was they released a 128K model of the Spectrum, which kind of like had more than double the memory. So there was various versions of that. The Spectrum Plus, the Spectrum Plus 2, which I've got one next to me, with the built-in tape deck. That was after Sinclair had sold out to Amstrad. Sinclair basically lost a lot of money. And once the Spectrum kind of became a games machine, I think Sinclair lost interest, because he wasn't particularly a games kind of guy. He just liked it as a computer, as a bit of kit, as an invention. So, yeah, he sold the whole thing off to Amstrad, and they did the Spectrum Plus 2, and then the Spectrum Plus 3, which had a disk drive. But by that time, you're starting to get like the Atari ST, the Commodore Amiga, these 16-bit computers, which can actually do like proper color and proper music and things like that. And Spectrum games, you know, by that point, the Spectrum was almost 10 years old. And, you know, they did look pretty prehistoric. So, yeah, it was inevitable that, you know, a lot of the big publishers started to divert all their attention to games for these new 16-bit platforms. And, you know, in adverts in the magazines, you'd start to see that the Spectrum screenshots weren't used as much. And it was more kind of like, here's what it looks like on the sexy new computers. So it was just the passage of time, I think. But that volume of games kind of means that the Spectrum's a really exciting computer to revisit now, because there's so much stuff. And like I say, I mean, most of it is rubbish. But you can just kind of rummage around in it like a, you know, like a tombola or a lucky dip. And every now and again, you'll find a game that you've never heard of that maybe like 11 people have played in the last 40 years. I'd go, oh, this is really good, actually. This is, you know, it's a shame that nobody knew about this.
Yeah, I like in your introduction, obviously, our podcast looks back at games from the 80s. And you say that, you know, we take comfort from nostalgia, but it also has an important role of understanding the breadcrumbs of where we've come from and understanding who we are. So,
I mean, one of the kind of things I really wanted to get across with Specky Nation, I wrote the first Specky Nation in 2012, which was the 30th anniversary of the Spectrum. And, you know, as an old Spectrum head, I was like, you know, 30th anniversary, oh my God. So I was looking for, like, to see if there were any books about it, and there weren't. So I thought, well, I might as well write one myself. And one of the things I wanted to get across, rather than just going, hey, here's a bunch of games, do you remember these, was this idea that because the Spectrum was such a weird computer, because you had to be quite inventive to get the most out of it, and because pretty much every British software company had to make Spectrum games, you kind of get this innovation baked into the British games industry right from the very start. And, you know, it's no surprise that games like Tomb Raider and Grand Theft Auto came out of Britain, because there will have been people involved in those franchises at the very start who also had one foot in the Spectrum era. So you have the, you know, these were ambitious games in their own right for their own hardware. And I don't think you would get this kind of... Britain punches above its weight as a games developer. And I think the Spectrum is a big part of that, because, you know, games companies had to be clever and innovative and unusual thinking just to make good games on the Spectrum. And I think that made us better game developers as a nation.
Absolutely. And I urge everyone to get a hold of your books. Are they available generally still, Dan?
If you just go on Amazon, if you look on Amazon and search for Specky Nation, there's Specky Nation Volume 1, Specky Nation Volume 2. And there's also, for those of you who are really hardcore, there's a quiz book, which is back to front there. But yeah, if you really want to test yourself, there's the questions are kind of, even I can't remember the answers to some of them when I wrote it. So.
Well, I think anybody who wants to have an idea, as I say, British culture back in the 1980s, I urge you to get hold of it. Because we've not even talked about the Sam Fox game, but maybe another time.
That was a very famous one, yeah. The Sabrina game, that's the really obscure one. The Sabrina, the busty Italian pop star, she had a game where she was like a scrolling beat-em-up where she beats people up with her giant breasts.
So, maybe another time.
All these weird little things in the corners of Spectrum games that I love.
Thanks, Dan. Okay, everyone. Is anybody want to put up their hand to ask Dan a question? What have we got in?
Yeah, hi, Dan. So what's the... because I know the kind of the specky thing is still... there's a load of interest in it, and there's like new machines and stuff like that. But what would you say is the best way to just kind of go back to those games and play them now?
The easy way is to download an emulator. There's one called Fuse, which is really good. And then there are sites. There's one called World of Spectrum. There's one called ZX Spectrum Computing or Spectrum Computing. And basically they have every game you can download and also look up all the info, and they've got the cassette inlays and maps and tips and everything all in one place. So if you want the quick and easy way, that's the best way to do it, and just kind of dip in and search for the ones you remember and have a go. If you get bitten by the bug and become tragically addicted to the whole thing, you can go on eBay and you can pick up like refurbished original Spectrums, you know, pretty cheap these days, you know, sort of 50 quid or so. And then there are loads of like bundles of old games that people are selling on there as well, as long as you're not chasing like the really rare stuff, which is generally games that kind of came out around 1993 when the Spectrum was dying, and publishers would only like put out like 1,000 copies of something, like games like RoboCop 3, Count Duckula 2. They're terrible games, but they go for like crazy money because there were so few of them produced for the Spectrum. And you know, yeah, it's, as long as you don't mind kind of, you know, there's always that thing of like old hardware. Yeah. Will it still work? Old, but I mean, I've got like loads of old tapes still. You know, there's my favorite game, Games Workshop's Chaos, War of the Wizards. I still got its boots sticker on the front, £7.95. You know, there's loads of them, and they still work amazingly. Sometimes you'll get a tape that doesn't, but considering it's a magnetic medium from like 40 years ago, I'm amazed at how many of them just look perfectly fine. But I think playing them on the original hardware feels better. It's kind of like that old kind of like vinyl purist kind of thing. You know, yes, you can listen to stuff on Spotify, but sometimes you want to like put an actual record on, and there's the ritual of it, you know, the loading it and the click of the cassette and all that. If you want that kind of like fetishistic kind of thing, then yeah, it's very affordable to get involved in the actual original hardware. But it's also very costly because you end up spending like hundreds of pounds. And I had like shelves and shelves and shelves of them, and eventually I had to get rid of them because they were taking up so much room, and it was just like, I love them, but it's daft.
We're used to spending lots of money on games, so I don't think that'll be a problem.
Yeah.
So I know there's also newer games as well, like there's still games being made. How do you rate the newer games versus like those, the games from the originals, I guess?
I mean, the thing is, a lot of the newer games are really good, mostly because they're kind of being made by people who've had so long to get used to the hardware now. There was a puzzle game called Buzzsaw, which came out around 2012, around the 30th anniversary. It was like a, you know, homebrew game that a guy made because he just loved the Spectrum and programming for the Spectrum. And it kind of solved the famous color clash problem, which was one of the kind of quirks of the Spectrum. The Commodore 64 could do colors, and you could put colors next to each other and it looked okay. The Spectrum, if you put colors next to each other, they kind of overlapped and went horrible. And it's one of those things, it's like, it's such a weakness of the computer, but it's one of the things that kind of defines it now, is that kind of slightly rough-edged kind of flaw to it. But Buzzsaw solved that problem, and it had like colorful graphics that didn't have color clash. And I remember at the time the community was like, oh my god, solving color clash was like, you know, kind of like discovering like the kind of perpetual energy machine or something. It was like kind of a holy grail for the community. But there's a granular nature to Spectrum graphics, which I've always loved. They're very finely detailed because they have very small pixels. Commodore 64 had quite big chunky pixels, so although it could do color, the graphics weren't as interesting to me. The Spectrum, you get these really lovely detailed pixel art, but the color is a nightmare. You kind of have to take the rough with the smooth a bit, really.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. It's been great having you as part of our weekend.
Thank you.
Do you like to peek behind the curtain? Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars takes you behind the scenes. We interview designers and discover how they make their games. What was the first spark, that first idea? How did that idea develop into a game thousands of people love and play? These are the questions we ask designers. So if you want in-depth interviews with people like Shane Helmsley, John Wick, Ed Greenwood, and John Harper, check out Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars on your favorite podcatcher.
Thanks to Dan for his tour around Spectrum Games. The Specky Nation books are available via Amazon. They're a really worthwhile investment, as you'll spend hours with them. I have another book recommendation, which is tangentially related to the topic, in that it's set in the world of computer game coding, and the protagonists meet each other playing console games. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin really doesn't need my endorsement, as it's a worldwide bestseller. Rightly so, as it is a brilliant work of fiction. The three central characters are so vivid that you'll enjoy being in their company. It's a book about friendship, creativity, competitiveness, collaboration, and the fragility of human life. It's set in that moment when computer gaming made a shift and the game engines drove different kinds of realities, and it was possible for individual coders to break out new ideas without it being over-professionalised. Great stuff. Put it on your holiday reading list. I made a conscious effort over the past few years to find time in the day to read fiction, participating in less social media interactions, and putting the book next to the kettle has really boosted my reading time. In the first half of the year, the Grognard Files Book Club, that usually meets on the first Sunday of the month at 9:30 in the morning, except when it doesn't, has been reading fantasy novels, Liber, Vance, as well as The Broken Sword by Paul Anderson and Mathargo Wood by Robert Holstock. In the second half of the year, we're doing some science fiction classics, and I mean classics. Dune, which, despite a number of attempts, I still haven't read, Ringworld, The Left Hand of Darkness, Neuromancer, and High Rise. The book club is very informal, and you are very welcome to attend. See the Grognard Files book club page for details. Regular listeners might notice a bit of a change of format from this episode onwards. The pods are getting a bit too long, so we're sticking to the usual segments, but splitting them in two and releasing them close together, you know, like Springsteen did that time. It'll mean that if we have interviews and other bits of editorial, they'll be released as a separate pod from the Room of Roleplaying Rambling with resident rules lawyer Judge Blythe. They'll be both shorter and longer, if you know what I mean. It'll give us a bit more space and flexibility, as it'll mean that we can have some off-topic interviews and other bits and pieces. In the second part of this episode, Judge Blythe and I think back to our computer games experiences, and we also talk about some of the RPGs that we've been playing recently. Until then, adios, amigos.